This episode of the Police One podcast is sponsored by Officer Store. Learn more about getting the gear you need at prices you can afford by visiting officerstore.com. Hey, welcome back to Policing Matters on policeone.com. I'm your host, Jim Dudley. Hey, thanks for checking in, and I hope you're checking in on our YouTubes as well. You can check out what our speakers look like, and we might have a graphic or two in there for you as well. Well, we have early intervention systems at most agencies around the country where we want to check an officer's report writing, their arrests, what are they doing with their time, their vacation, are they calling in sick a lot, are they getting into a lot of collisions? But what do we do to check in on their mental wellness and health? Across the country, we may be doing some little things, but we've got some great experts today to talk about some best practices, what they've seen and what they're doing at their agencies, and what we can do further on as well. So today I have Chief Dave Norris with the Menlo Park Police Department and a former Policing Matters guest, and welcome him back to the show, Kansas City Police Chaplain. Do I have that right?
Yes, Jared Altick? Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm with the Kansas City, Kansas Police Department
Chaplain Jared Altick. Welcome back, and welcome Chief Norris as well.
Thank you, Jim.
I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, so you both have a vast experience at your agencies dealing with critical incident aftermaths, debriefings, and things like that. A lot of that is reactive. The grief is already stricken. What are we doing to check in as a preemptory strike for an officer's mental health and well-being? Chief Norris, what are you doing out there in Menlo Park?
Well, I, you know, one of the things that I discovered early on, and I've been at Menlo Park now for 2.5 years and at the city of San Mateo Police Department for 28 prior to that. So a little slightly larger agency experience for most of my career. This is a little bit smaller family type environment. And we had something come up really kind of very quickly into my tenure here, where I had three officers who had all suffered some pretty significant losses all in the same week. And so I turned to my command staff and I said, well, you know, what do we have in terms of peer support or chaplaincy program? And our programs were, I'll say, a little bit stale. So we hadn't really refreshed or rebuilt those programs in a long time. And so we engaged in a pretty significant endeavor to rebuild some of our wellness tools. At the same time that I had asked that question, Danny O'Connor, who's my assistant and a management analyst, was working on a number of tools across the wellness spectrum. And so, we brought in a team of psychologists who we were already intending to bring in some type of support network for our folks. But they also were experts in building a peer support program. And so, we did an introduction with them. They talked about what they can do one-on-one in terms of psychology counseling, but also what they could do in a team situation, such as a critical incident debrief, and then the peer support program. And they used what they call a blind nomination process, where they asked each of the officers to write down the names of a couple of people within the organization that they really feel comfortable approaching and could trust. And they used that to compile a list of a peer support team. And we just completely refreshed that program. And at the same time, you know, we're looking to refresh our chaplaincy program, and we're using our connections through Faith and Blue Weekend, which occurs the first weekend in October, to try and, you know, build those bonds and start that relationship up.
So, you know, I always like to say the best army is a volunteer army, but your process might encourage some reluctant volunteers. So are they voluntold to be a peer resource officer?
It's still a volunteer process, Jim. So we compile those names, and then we used the vendor, the psychology services group to come back in and engage with all these nominees to say, look, you're a person who's entrusted within the organization. We can really use whatever intangible it is that you have that makes you approachable, and you can provide a service to the organization. And the vast majority of the folks who were nominated were willing to, you know, take the next step, which is to go through a training class that is required for peer support, because there is a confidentiality aspect to peer support, but you have to have the training and the certification to do that. And many of them were fully willing to step into that.
Oh, that's awesome. And Chaplain Jared, hey, Chaplain, you've got a podcast called Hey Chaplain, and it's a great one. Yeah. I've heard it. And you've talked about peer support programs. What role do you play in those?
Well, for me, the focus is primarily on the chaplaincy program. And ideally, your chaplaincy program and your peer support would be working hand in hand. That's not always the case. Anything related to health, including mental health, is like a river, and it's flowing toward the waterfall. And if you want to stay healthy, you have to actively put in energy to keep it going, to keep going, moving upstream and towards something healthier versus toward disaster. So peer support teams start out great, and then people get busy and they're not utilized every day. And so it kind of gets put on the back burner, and they kind of start to fall apart and get dusty and that kind of thing. Chaplaincy is exactly the same way. You've got chaplains, most of whom are not sworn officers. They are at least 1 foot outside the department, sometimes both feet outside of the department. And so they are removed and excluded and forgotten about. And that goes both ways. There are chaplains who do not invest. They do not show up to roll calls. They don't learn the officers' names. And when the department and the chaplain are neither one investing in the relationship, and you have a crisis, then the two are strangers to each other. And that's a problem. So with both chaplains and peer support, you've got to constantly be refreshing it and making it better. You got to be paddling upstream, or it's not going to be, either one of them, a very useful tool when an emergency happens.
Yeah. And it's like investing in a bank. You just keep making those deposits of goodwill. Right. People get more comfortable. I've heard you talk about that people look at you with suspicion when you walk in sometimes, and you've got to earn that trust. How do you do it?
It takes a long time. And that's where one of the advantages, there's two roles that a chaplain plays in an emergency. One is that he can be a resource to the chief, because he presumably is officiating funerals and working in the faith community, and he knows all of the people in the community, the funeral homes, the different services. Maybe a lot of chaplains are also trained counselors, and so they know the mental health professionals in town and who can be rallied to help. And so being a liaison that brings resources to the table or helps to help the people who need to know each other meet, that's one aspect where a chaplain can be very useful. But the other one is to be the boots on the ground with those officers. For me, I'm a patrol chaplain. And so I'm doing like 180 roll calls every year. And I'm doing ride-alongs. And I know the patrol officers in my department. I know them by name, and they know me. And we recognize each other out of uniform at Walmart. And we know each other. And that means that I'm familiar with what they're going through. I've sat through those meetings about their retirement program, or who's in trouble for, you know, wrecking a car or whatever it is. And I know what's going on in their life. And so when they have a family emergency or an officer involved shooting or whatever it may be, anything in between, I'm already familiar with them, and I've built rapport, and I've spent years doing that. And so the counselors and the peer support and everything else, those are all great programs, and that's all good stuff, and it all has its place. But a lot of departments are lacking a chaplain who is that involved and knows maybe several dozen or even 100 officers on that kind of level. That's a great resource when you have it. But it's hard to find these people, because police chaplains are almost always volunteer. And so finding them, training them, and getting them involved, and then keeping that up, you know, the paddling upstream thing, That's a hard task. And there are some great chaplains all around the country that are each doing that in their department. And those departments, I think, really benefit. But I mean, that's a hard thing to find. You can't just, you know, the chief can't give an order. Okay, we're now going to have an effective chaplaincy program. Good luck. That can be difficult to just produce.
Right. Everybody get in the just box. Like, line up.
Yeah. Just like anything else in our business, right? There has to be a certain amount of trust building, and there has to be a certain amount of, front work done to build the relationship. And that's where, you know, I think Jared hit it on the head, you know, on both sides, that clergy can build trust within the community of the police department, build trust within the community at large outside of the department. And, you know, there are agencies, and we've had these discussions here in Menlo Park, where the community is not always ready to come forward and talk to us about some of the hard topics along with, you know, with the changes that are occurring in policing. And sometimes clergy can be a real connector on that and be able to help us to bridge that gap of you know, folks don't want to approach us because either they're worried that the police will be defensive or dismissive of whatever the commentary is. And to have that clergy member who either can, you know, either vouch for the credibility of that police department or make the connection between that member of the public and the police to say, I, you know, go see Commander so-and-so or go see Sergeant so-and-so. I trust them. Right. And you can talk to them. And that's, you know, that's important.
But that trust thing is so difficult to maintain, because we were talking in the green room earlier. With chaplains, they're just like everybody else, but even worse. You'll have some chaplains that are admirable, great people, extremely helpful to your department. And then there are chaplains who are goofballs, and they are just strange people, and you're not sure why they became a chaplain. They don't seem to like the police. You can't really put a finger on what they're doing or why they're there. And all you need is one bad chaplain to sour an agency on ever having a chaplain ever again.
Right.
And so, I hope they're patient with that.
Yeah, I have a theory on that, Jared, and the theory is that chaplaincy, like some other things that are collateral to the police business, is a super high empathy business, right?
Yeah.
But because it's a super high empathy endeavor, that means that you can be super empathetic to the police department, or you could be super empathetic to your constituency as a clergy member in the public, to your congregation. And, you know, the depth with which you will believe, you know, either side of that is dependent on your level of empathy to that side. And so sometimes you can't quite get the connection and that parallel between what we're hearing and what the public is saying, or vice versa, because there's too much empathy on one side or the other. And like, too much empathy is a great problem to have, but it does really impact our profession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Chief, management by walking around only goes so far. And you're in a mid-sized agency. You were with a larger agency before. And a lot of our listeners are in smaller agencies where it may be easier for the chief to jump in, surprise somebody and say, hey, I'm going to ride along with you for an hour or two, or a shift. And how do you do that in the larger agency? How do you gauge? So if we're talking preemptive wellness checks as the lead of your agency, how are you doing that with 200 or so employees?
So, you know, we had at San Mateo, we had a little bit over 100 sworn. I have just under 50 in my agency. And the difference is profound, right? When you're in a place like I was in San Mateo, where it's this, you know, three-story, 50,000 square foot building, where, you know, at any given moment, you cannot make connections with everybody who's working there, to here, where, you know, if I want to step out of my office and stretch my legs for 5 minutes, I can connect with everybody who's working. It's a huge difference. But either way, and even if you're working with smaller organizations, you don't always see all of the things that are going on. And so what you're doing in terms of preparation or resiliency is really important. And that's why, you know, we will bring in this peer support element. We'll work on this chaplaincy element, but we also need to work on some of that pre-work and wellness. And, you know, Menlo Park several years ago was on a heavy wellness angle. This was prior to my time here. Went on a retreat, actually, a wellness retreat to try and work on their resiliency. It was a little bit of a mismatch. There were some officers that were really accepting, and there were some that were really not accepting of that. And I think that had to do with, you know, they were just being told this is what we're doing. And so I had a conversation with one of our senior people who I knew didn't receive that previous tactic too well. And I jokingly said to him, you know, hey, there's an app for that. And he actually looked at me. He's like, wow, that would be really awesome, and took me completely by surprise. And so we know that there are a couple of different options out there that are mobile apps that aggregate all of the available services that you have. I think those are great because, you know, this is the generation that really wants that at their fingertips. But in terms of what we offer, you know, holistically, in addition to making sure that we have a way and a place for our officers to get their physical training and their workouts, we have also partnered, because we're a small agency, with two other small agencies in our neighborhood to hire one full-time wellness coordinator who will do a full holistic workup of that officer's health and well-being, their diet, their nutrition, do the blood work to determine kind of where they're at health-wise, and then to, you know, coordinate that with if there are other things that you know, work their way into the mental health realm that are outside of that person's expertise, refer them to make sure that they're getting that care. But this is a, you know, a full look at the inside and you know, how we're built and how we're put together and how we maintain ourselves as well. And we could not have done that without a generous grant from one of the community members that will help kind of seed this program. But to have one person who's dedicated to about 100 officers is a model that obviously could be replicated, because then if you have larger agencies or smaller agencies, you could see the scalability of that. So we really like that. We're in the very, very early stages of that. We just onboarded our wellness coordinator. We're just starting to get that person introduced around. But we are really looking forward to seeing how that impacts our officers' overall well-being, because in the event of a critical incident, all of these things that we talked about at the front of this program are really important, right? Having the peer support network, having you know, someone in a chaplaincy program, that critical incident debrief. But what you do before that and how you have your officers feeling strong inside and out is really important as you lead up to that. And it also helps to, you know, to build better bonds between our folks, and they feel supported. And hopefully that will help them in the event that something happens, that they know that they can turn to the right resources.
Mm-hmm. And of course, some of the major stressors, not just from work, but outside of work, maybe debt or alcoholism or drug use or some other family oriented situation might be affecting an officer's performance. I talked a little bit about early intervention, and sometimes we could spot it there. Chaplain Jared, how does the confidentiality issue prevent you from making some suggestions, maybe to management, to the chief, that an officer might need reassignment or some other kind of support?
That's difficult. Obviously, if somebody is reporting that they're going to hurt themselves or hurt someone else, then there's just an obvious that has to be reported. And really, everyone has heard that so many times that that's accepted. The problem is that we don't know what we're always looking at when it comes to mental health. You go and talk to somebody and have this great talk, and this happens all the time, that they'll talk to a buddy or they'll talk to a professional, and the professional or the buddy feels like, wow, that was really productive talk. That was really good. But what it did is it just resolved things enough for the person to go ahead and go take their own life. And that is sometimes it's maybe the calm before the storm, or there's lots of different ways to look at it, but it really surprises everybody. It's like, boy, I thought they were doing better. Well, they didn't. They just resolved. They went around and made amends and took care of all their unfinished business. And now they felt like they had the green light to go ahead and do what they were going to do. And so you never can tell. And even the professionals get surprised by it. And so, I mean, when it comes to your question specifically about confidentiality, we have to be on our guard, but we can never know for certain. Mm-hmm. So there's times where we do make suggestions in generalities. Hey, I don't think morale is very good right now. You know, what can we do? Or is there some thing that we can think outside the box and find some sort of relief? Because obviously we can't just give them more money or give them more time off. Neither one of those things are available right now. Mm-hmm. So what can we do? And let's brainstorm. And hopefully leadership will understand, I cannot tell you who I'm referencing. I can't, it would be a breach of that confidentiality. It's just not ethical for me to tell you who specifically needs help. But do you understand that your people always need help? My concern, and I know you have a lot of executive leadership that listen to this show, I don't want them to ever, through complacency, fall into the trap of thinking in terms of break glass in case of emergency. You have to be proactive. What Chief Norris is talking about, that is perfect. Yes, let's talk about your physical health. Let's bring in a wellness coordinator. Let's do what we can do and be actively working for it. Let's challenge everybody to a fitness thing, or let's attack this from 10 different ways and be actively working on it all the time. Because if you don't, boy, before you know it, a year goes by and then 10 years, and then you don't have the tools you need. So be proactive. That is absolutely critical.
Yeah. Great words. Jared,
I have a question for you, Jared, on the executive side. So I think, you know, it's accurate to say that you can identify certain trends, right, that are happening, that are creating issues within the organization or with a particular individual, but you could see where that what you're learning from that individual might be important to the entire organization, right? Do you spend time also working with your chief executives on how you lay that information out to the rest of the department? When you land on something that's really important and you know it's important, but you don't want to quote unquote dime somebody out or you know, cause everybody to go, oh yeah, that's Joe. Then, you know, but it's important to the whole organization. How do you approach that as a chaplain?
Our agency is about 350 sworn. And so that's just big enough. It's not a big agency, but it's a large, medium-sized agency. And so we're big enough that I honestly do not interact and interface with the chief's office regularly. I'm very much at the captain and sergeant level and below. And so I know my captains real well. I know my sergeants really well. I know my officers really well. The majors and the colonels, they know me. We work well together, but I don't interact with them regularly. And so I don't have that kind of, I'm not in the chief's office. And in fact, I kind of would avoid it if I had the choice, because I don't want to be seen as somebody from the chief's office. That's sometimes detrimental to those officers who are on the street and they feel like the chief's office is antagonistic toward them. So I don't want to encourage that, but I don't want to get pulled into that either. And so that's challenging. Now I forget what your question was, but
when you identify trends, you know, how do you communicate those trends to command staff?
Yeah. Part of it is I go through channels. And so I'm not part of the command and control structure, but I understand that the captains all are going to have meetings with their superiors, and I can pass things up through them. And sometimes that's the appropriate level. I'm going to say, hey, Captain, I don't know if you realize, but there's a problem over here in this division. Can you bring this up to command? And I'll let that captain carry that message. Frankly, if I get involved too much, that can be detrimental to the help that I'm trying to provide. I want that 25-year-old officer to understand that I know him, that I care about him, and that I'm going to support him, even if the department fires him. I'm still going to be his chaplain. And so I don't want to be seen as being the chief's man or the person from the chief's office. And sometimes having a little bit of separation there is good for me. And I'm in a department large enough that I can do that. Obviously, in a small rural department where there's only 12 people, everybody knows everybody, and that's a whole different dynamic. That's a different puzzle, different Gordian knot to try to untie.
So. Absolutely.
Yeah. And to remind the listeners out there, the majority of law enforcement agencies are under 20 yes. people. So yeah. You guys are mid-size to large, at least. Officer Store, equipping protectors with passion. That's how we operate, and it's how we live. We understand that having the right gear can mean the difference between life and death. Our goal is to get you the gear you need, when you need it, at prices you can afford. Visit us at officerstore.com. Hey, I want to wrap it up. I appreciate both your time. I want to ask one last question. There's memes and people joke about the pizza party, right? And you see the meme of the awful, terrible road, and then about a tenth of a mile of clean paved road followed by the rough road again. And that clean paved road is the pizza party. Chief Norris, what are you doing for your troops to let them know that you want to hear from them? And then we want to give some of the onus back on the individuals to say, hey, I need help. I mean, we can't just, put everybody under a microscope and try to figure out what's wrong, but there should be some personal responsibility, right?
Yeah. One of the first things that I learned, Jim, when I first took on Menlo Park PD, had the opportunity to come in. My first 2 days happened to be, we work in a 4 day on, 4 day off, 2-team schedule, which a lot of agencies do, right? Four work days, and then you're off for four, and the other team is working. So it's a little bit of a divided team. I happened to be on the Friday of one team and the Monday of the other. So I spent those two long days, making sure that I hit briefings at all four of our briefing shifts. And one of the biggest themes that I heard through that, and then through having one-on-ones with everybody in the organization, was communication. They wanted more communication. They wanted to understand more what the thinking and thought process was of the administrative part of the department, as well as the decision making process, kind of from the city council, et cetera. And so my department gets an email every Friday from me. And that's one of the ways that I'm trying to build that communication thread. And so it follows kind of a loose formula of, recognition of good work, a little bit of what's happening at the police department decision-making level, a little bit of what's happening at the city or political decision-making level. And then maybe a little bit of what's in my head that week, or what's on my playlist that week, or what am I thinking about? And that seems to have been taken well by the department. It doesn't elicit return emails or return messages directly from our team, but it does make what I call the parking lot conversations a lot easier. So if I'm, pulling into the parking lot, and I've got a couple of our folks out there that are getting their cars ready or getting back in after doing their reports, we can have a conversation, and there's a little bit more to talk about, right? That's topical. So that's one way that we're trying to kind of build that communication level. And then being in a small department, all I have to do is get up and walk around, and I can have face-to-face conversations. And that is so much nicer than, sitting in my captain's office in my old agency and not being able to connect with everybody on any given day.
Yeah. Yeah,
and if I could real quick, there's an old saying that says that they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And Chief, you going around and just walking around and having face-to-face time, which is an advantage of being in a somewhat smaller department, but that is going to matter to people. And I think our youngest generation of law enforcement officers, it seems to especially matter to them. They would much rather have 2 or 3 minutes of face-to-face contact than a pizza. I've seen young officers quit higher paying jobs and go to a lower paying job because they felt like they were cared about. I don't know how they define that or how they measure it, but they feel it. And so if you can figure out in your agency how to help them feel that you genuinely hear them and care about them, that may fix more than having an extra $1 million in your budget.
Yeah, and if I could just jump in, I wanted to tell Chief Norris, don't undersell yourself, because you are great on social media. I see you supporting your troops all the time in the community, and often bringing the community in the social media posts as well. So I think those go a long way. We love to put our people up to the public as them, being the frontline people doing the work. And I think that's a great sign of great leadership.
Yeah.
And I want to wrap it up and thank you both. Chaplain Jared Altick. Hey, Chaplain, check out his podcast. Hey, Chaplain, Kansas City, Kansas. and Chief Dave Norris at Menlo Park PD here in California, doing a great job here. Thank you both for your time and your efforts on behalf of our sworn officers and your non-sworn people as well. But reaching out before becomes critical, making sure that they're taken care of and that you care. And I think that goes a long way, large, small, or medium-sized department.
That's right. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, Jim.
All right. Hey, thank to our so listeners. Much. Our listeners, thanks for listening, and I hope you found some good advice and some tips. And don't struggle in silence. Speak up. Find out who your chaplain is if you don't know who that might be, and get heard. And don't let it get to a situation where it becomes critical. All right, let me know. Drop me a line at policingmatters@policeone.com, policingmatters@policeone.com. All right, stay safe. Thanks for what you do. Talk to you again real soon.